the wonderful playing of Cahal O'Doul with Graffiti Classics, and that viola solo, of course, with Stephen Kennedy. A beautiful combo, and they were here on the 20th of December last year. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to The Classical Journey. This is Phonic FM. I'm Luke Kasia-Jerrick, and I'm joined in the studio this morning by the producer of the Exeter University Theatre Company, Georgia Posner.
Good morning.
Good morning, Georgia, and welcome back. And Georgia has been telling me at great length about the wonderful characters and set that are going into the play, which is opening tomorrow night at the Northcott Theatre. And this play has really, I think, stretched everyone to the limits.
Yeah, I don't think any of us have done anything on this scale before. And I think when the directors said that they wanted a three-story building, that was probably the original big issue. I say issue, excitement, but it was a stretch for us, as you say. I think we didn't know how to go about it. We have contacted a local scaffolding company and they're helping us. But it was really our design and our imagination that's really come up with it and built it and gone through with it.
Now, have you had a chance to use the scaffold?
Not with the actors. That's going to happen today.
Right.
So we were only able to get into the theatre yesterday. We only have a couple of days to have our what's called a get-in. And then the actors begin and it's opening night. So yesterday was the set going up. Today will be the technical rehearsals, so sorting out the lighting, making sure the sound is all good. There's a lot of Eric Clapton played. That's the Violets and Matriarchs' favourite music. So we'll be hearing a lot of blues and Eric Clapton. So we're going to make sure that that sounds all very good through the speakers. And then it'll be the dress. And then it's opening night tomorrow night.
And the Eric Clapton, is this part of the story or will this be in the background?
It's just in the background. I think it just gives you a sense of the style of the piece. It's quite mournful, I suppose, but also, which I think some Eric Clapton songs can be, but also full of life and excitement and enjoyment. And I think it's just going to create the atmosphere of this hazy day in Oklahoma where the heat is just unbearable. And I think few people can do that better than Eric Clapton.
Always remember the heat. That's the thing.
Yes.
That's making it very oppressive for all of these people in this house. Big as it is, it's very claustrophobic for all of them.
Well, Violet refuses to let any light into the house. She likes it dark and she doesn't like it. She doesn't like any air conditioning. So it's 40 degree heat with no air conditioning and all the windows completely blacked out. And so the majority of the characters spend a lot of the play complaining about the heat and sweltering. And I think that adds a real air to it. It's this kind of fatigue and catharsis, which is obviously with what they're going through, but also added by this oppressive atmosphere of the heat.
And they... Now, you've worked on accents as well.
We have. Accents has been a big thing, particularly for our director, Lucy Hurst. She's very particular on accents, and that's been a big thing. So obviously all the characters are speaking in a southern Oklahoma accent, which I'm not even going to attempt to try.
No.
I'm not an actor, but they are sounding so authentic. They're sounding really brilliant. We have had an American girl come in just to see some of the performance because she was curious, and she said it was so authentic and so genuine, and that was really enlightening to see, and great for us who've worked so hard. That was really lovely to see, actually, that our hard work is paying off.
Yes, and you mentioned, of course, that the set is supposed to be in darkness, so this is quite a challenge for the lighting crew.
Yeah.
It's got to look dark, and yet, of course, the action's going to be very
clear.
Well,
we need to be able to see the actors and their brilliant facial expressions, yeah.
Yeah. Now, how are they going to... I'm not trying to visualise this. How are they going to come to the front of the stage without falling off the scaffold?
So there is a space at the front of the stage. It's called an apron stage, and there is space where we've built some of the housing down there. So there's some rooms on the scaffolding, and then there's also some rooms on the stage itself. And so there will be space. Hopefully no one will fall. That's the hope.
It's a big stage at the North.
Yes, it is a big stage, and there's quite a lot of room for them.
Too pushed. Well, in a moment, I'd like to actually go over how people can get a ticket and how they can book themselves a seat. But one thing I haven't asked you yet is if there are any plans for future productions.
We haven't chosen our performance for the next year's Northcote show. That I won't be able to tell you, but we do have a few productions lined up in the future. Love Song is going to be on in the future, and then in about 5 weeks' time there'll be The History Boys by Alan Bennett, which is also very exciting.
Now, is this going to be in the M&D room?
That will be, yeah, that'll be in the M&D.
M&D, and when Dan McNeil was here, he was a former director, as you know, of the theatre company, and he didn't know what M&D stood for, which I thought was very interesting. And actually there's some debate about whether it's music and drama or music and debating.
Ah, I never heard debating, actually.
So, but it's M&D, and yes. I still can't remember. I think it's in Devonshire House.
Yes, it is, the ground floor of Devonshire House.
So if people know how to get into Devonshire House, that's a good start. It's quite near to the Northcote, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's sort of in the middle of the campus, I suppose.
Yes, and you can, if you go through the forum, if it's open, you can get to the entrance of Devonshire House from the Northcote, from the Great Hall. So that's what's coming up. That's 5 weeks' time, not far.
Yeah, it's a very quick turnaround.
So you're already working on a new production. Yeah. And, of course, the Northcote is the main thing. And whenever we have something at the Northcote, the easiest way to find out about it is to ring up box office, who are very, very helpful.
They are, yeah.
And I was going to get Georgia to tell us the number, but actually I don't know if you...
I'm afraid I don't remember it. I can tell you the website. I tend to do everything online. The website is exetonorthcote.co.uk, so that you can go onto and book your tickets online.
Yes, Exeter Northcote, that's all one word in lowercase. And it's Northcote with a double T on the
end.
It is,
yeah.
Northcote House is something else. And that's the way to find out. And if you want to find out more about these characters that George has been talking about, there is a web page or just a Facebook page?
We have a Facebook page, which is Utco Presents. That's EUTCO Presents. August Osage County, and we also have a blog which is blogspot.com/UCO present August Osage County.
Right, so if you explore those in your search engine, you will find them eventually. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Georgia. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and this play sounds wonderful. It opens tomorrow night and runs till Saturday.
Yes.
7:30 every day, no matinee on Saturday.
No matinee, and the tickets are £12 to £14.
£12 to £14. So that's actually the low end of the range for Northcote tickets.
Yeah.
And not a lot of variation. I presume that £14 means the front of the gallery, which is
£14 will be Friday and Saturday nights.
Ah, yes, so. I did realise that. So in fact it's same price throughout.
So it's best to book your tickets early because you'll be paying the same price as someone who has a worse seat than you if you book early.
The early bird gets the best
seat. Well,
seats.
They do.
Thank you so much, Georgina. It's been very interesting.
Thank you very much for having me.
And one last piece of music for you. And it's Graffiti Classics again. And we wanted something vaguely American. This is actually South American. It's a tango by Anton Cavas. It's La Camorcita. And that was the beautiful music of the Graffiti Classics. And in the background, we heard the voice of Georgia Posner. She was just telling me about the dress rehearsal, which is about to start up at the Northcote Theatre. So that play, we've been talking about it all morning, that's starting tomorrow night at 7:30. 493 is the number to get hold of. Well, a dance theme has come into the programme. That was the Camposita, the tango, and now a little music by Manuel da Falla. This is the Ritual Fire Dance. That was the Ritual Fire Dance by Manuel da Falla. And we have a little more dance music in a moment. Now, the plan for this morning on the classical journey is that at 11:30 this morning, I'll be talking to Julie Sampson. Julie Sampson, who was on The Mighty Book last week, and she was talking about her poetry, and about her recent publication, Tessitura, and also her studies into the female writers of Devon and the South West, which she has also recently published. And Julie didn't actually read us any poetry on that occasion, because on Thursday we had uncut
poets here at the Phoenix, up in the Black Box. And we have Uncut Poets every month on the first Thursday of the month. And worth coming along to. That starts at about 8 o'clock in the evening and is very informal. And we have a variety of local poets come and read their poetry, but there is generally one or possibly two very high-profile poets come and read to us. And one of them last Thursday was Julie Sampson. So at 11:30, Julie will be speaking to us from Taunton again, but this time she will read us some more poetry as she did last Thursday. And as we're talking, and she'll also tell us a little bit more about this project of investigating and researching the female poets and authors of the Southwest. So to put us in mind of that, let's listen to some music by two women from Devon. They are Emma Graham and Liz Greer. Regular listeners to this programme know what I'm talking about. They are two harp players. They both have very beautiful concert harps, both of which are predominantly black in colour. And so they call their duo Harp Noir, which makes perfect sense, of course. And we've heard last... 2 weeks ago, I think it was, we had a few tracks from their concert, which they gave. And the concert was at St. Michael's Church, Mount Dunham, on the 15th of January. And they played a beautiful selection of music, not all written for two harps, in some cases written for harp and flute or harp and piano, and then beautifully transcribed by Emma, or even music for single harp, which they'd split up between them, and very often that would be the work of Emma as well. But this piece that we're going to listen to now is by a female composer, Paula Chertok, and is actually written for two harps. This is recorded live at St. Michael's Mount Dinham by Michael Glewis, our illustrious audio recorder and editor, and this is his beautiful recording of Emma Graham and Liz Greer playing Paula Chertok's 10 Past 2.
Yes, last one. Last one. Last one. Now, this is another piece of music that exists as a solo to which an additional part has been added. And again, unfortunately, only one movement of a group of four has had the treatment. It's actually a suite of music called Around the Clock. And basically, it's the story of a party. And it starts with the one that we're going to play, which is 10 past two. And it's got a little sort of bit of writing with it, which says, early afternoon, and you walk along the avenue, you look in the shop windows and are fascinated by the glitter. It's a woman, by the way, composer. You stop at the window and a gown shimmering with sequins makes you tingle with delight. Then you walk again, taking in the displays made just for you. So that's the one we're playing, 10 past two. If you'd like to hear the rest of the suite, it is available on my solo album. Do contact me. It's a slightly jazz-inspired piece. It's written in the 1920s, and you can really hear it. Think Great Gatsby.
Thank you.
final round of applause at the performance of Harp Noir by Emma Graham and Liz Greer. And they were playing there the music of Paula Chertok. That was 2:10, and I was caught out there. That was not a piece for two harps. Emma, once again, had written the second part for Liz to play. And while they were playing, I was talking on the telephone to Julie Sampson. And Julie, you're with us now, I think.
Yes, I am indeed, Luke.
Oh,
yes.
Hello, Julie. Hello, it's lovely, lovely to speak to you again.
Lovely to speak to you as well. I hope you've got the sunshine that we've got briefly here up in Taunton.
I'm sorry to say that down here in the basement of the Phoenix, we see no sun at all. And in fact, the same would have been true if you'd given your performance during the daytime last Thursday, because you were in the black box upstairs.
Yes, I was indeed, yes.
And
yes,
you gave us, you read us some beautiful poems there. I wasn't quite sure which was which as we went along. What did you read to us?
Oh, I read a selection. I read some that are included in my book that's just been published called Tessitura. And then I also read from a poem sequence that I'd written before, or I wanted to have included in the book, but actually it was so long that it couldn't be in the book. So its presence is very much in the book, but nobody else would be aware of that because it's not there. So I wanted to sort of make that in the background. So on Thursday, what happened was I wasn't quite sure how long I had, so I actually just read the second half of my reading, so possibly people were a little bit bemused. It's possible.
Well, it was very beautiful. I don't think it was all that important to know which poem was which and when you switched from one to the other. I think you did read a few titles.
Yes, I did. And I mean, what I'll do for you this morning, if you would like, is I'll try to make very clear what I'm reading.
I think that would be lovely.
Yeah.
But of course, you were with us last week on a very different program. That was The Mighty Book, which, of
yes,
course, is a literature program. And we were talking about your book. And for the benefit of the Classical Journey listeners, would you like to tell us again a little bit about the research that you've done into Southwest women writers?
Yes, well, I started, I think it must have been probably 12 to 13 or 14 years ago now, when I finished my PhD at Exeter University. I was researching the American writer Hilda Doolittle, HD, as she's always known. And one of the things about her that fascinated me when I finished my PhD was the fact that she actually spent a lot of time down in Devon and Cornwall, mostly Cornwall, but she did spend some months in 1916 in North Devon at a little place in Martinhoe called Woodland Cottage. And I was rather fascinated by that because nobody seemed to have written about it. So I sort of got carried away, and then I thought, well, I'll have a little look. I'll have a little think just for a bit of fun and a bit of respite from all the serious academic work that you need to do to get a PhD, and just look into the archives and see what I can find about women writers who lived in Devon. I was interested in Devon because I was brought up in Devon as a child. So I started to look, and I thought to start with would be very, very few women concerned. And I went to the West Country Studies Library, went to the record office, I went to the university, and I gradually accumulated lots of bits and pieces about lots of different names. And by the time sort of 5 years had gone by, I suddenly realized that actually there was a book waiting to be written. And that's really what's sort of taken me up since then. I have done lots of research. I've got a book that is more or less finished. I've written 3 drafts of it. This is the third one, and I hope the final one. And then when I've completed it, I'm hoping to get it to a publisher. That's my intention this year.
Yeah, it's very extraordinary that such a thing hasn't been done before, that you had to look all over the place for this information.
Well, I personally think this is the case for throughout the country. I'm hoping that other than one person whose name eludes me at this particular second, who's actually written a short kind of a fairly short book about women writers connected with Cornwall. I should have got it on my shelves, but I can't see it at this moment. But anyway, Alan, I think he's called Alan. If he's listening, he won't be very happy. But he wrote a book a few years ago about women writers from Cornwall, and that partly sort of gave me the idea after I'd done a lot of research. But other than him, I'm not aware of anyone who's done anything particularly similar concerning a particular county or area or district of the country. And I think there's a lot of writers, a lot of female writers out there who need to be kind of put back again on our literary canon, our literary map, in our literary canon and on the map, because they've somehow along the way been sort of just, almost some of them, just deleted. One particular writer, Mary Patricia Wilcox, who was born in 1869 and lived, I think, until, I think, the 50s, I think. She was born near Ivy Bridge, and she wrote many novels. She wrote some non-fiction, but mostly novels, which are absolutely really fascinating. They've got the moor as a backdrop, many of them, also some of the coastal places, and they should be known, but they're not. To me, she's our equivalent in Devon or the southwest of Mary Webb in Shropshire. But of course, for some reason, Mary Webb in Shropshire is fairly well known if you're into reading and fiction. But Mary Patricia Wilcox's connection with our Devonshire landscape and Devonshire history is not, it doesn't seem to be known about. And I have to say that I wouldn't myself have known about Mary Patricia Wilcox. I'm not sure if I would have found her in the archives, but I was helped along the way by the journalist or the writer from Totnes called Bob Mann. And I always like to mention his name, because without him, I would possibly never have found out about her. He's actually written several articles about Mary Patricia Wilcox in several journals. So she's one of the foremost writers that I think about when people mention or ask me questions. But then my research also goes right back to 16th century and even before that, but particularly the 16th century with the writer Anne Dowrich, who was born Anne Edgecombe from Mount Edgecombe and Coteil. And it was actually her father, Sir Richard Edgecombe, who built Mount Edgecombe, the mansion Mount Edgecombe, which of course since then has been burnt down, but he was the person who actually had it built. And I think, from all my research, I think his daughter Anne, who was one of his younger daughters, I think she was possibly born around about the years of the building of that early mansion. So it's quite interesting to sort of think about her and her background. I had a wonderful time when I went down to Mount Edgecombe, actually the very first time, which is several years ago now. I'd come across this Anne Edgecombe, who married Dowrich, and I'd come across her long epic poem called The French History, French Histoire. And I thought to myself, I'm going to go down to Mount Edgecombe and have a look and see if they've got anything at all in the archives. I knew the building wasn't original or anything, but went down there. And at the time, nobody seemed to be too sure as to who was the mother of Anne Edgecombe. Everyone was sure in the pieces that had been written about Anne as to the identity of her father, but nobody seemed to be sure about who her mother was. And I went to Mount Edgecombe and I talked to the staff, and they got sort of very into this, and they got out all the genealogical family history trees that they could find, which was very helpful. And in the end, we were able to discover that her mother, Anne Dowrich's mother, was a Tregean from Cornwall, which actually in itself leads to a very fascinating story, but probably not necessarily important today. But Anne Dowrich is a very important early Devonshire writer. She wrote this very, very long epic poem called The French Histoire, which is based on the events of the St. Bartholomew Massacre in Paris in 1572. And it's not exactly the sort of poem that's going to make you sort of sit down and think, oh, wow, this is a wonderful light poem.
Well,
it's a very difficult poem.
A woman we'd rather not remember, Catherine de' Medici, but...
Yes, exactly.
And a terrible... well... I suppose allowing people to do the terrible things that they want to do. Certainly an interesting story. Now, I presume that you have copies of all of these different works that you're talking about.
Yes and no, actually, Luke. I have copies of some, but it's funny you ask me that, because, you know, this morning, I don't know why, but yesterday I came across several data banks of different things, and I thought to myself, gosh, really, I have got everything, obviously, but it's not everything I've got has been kept really and organized towards my own book. But really, it's about time I started to sort of try and sift it and organize it in a slightly better fashion so that it can be kept somewhere in an archive. So I have got some copies of some of their texts and books, but not obviously not everything. It would take years to acquire everything, I think.
Yes.
But I've certainly got some of Mary Patricia Wilcox, and I've got copies of the French Histoire, of course. And another writer is the 17th century Mary Lady Chudley, who married Richard Chudley of Ashton, near Chudley. A bit confusing with the names of the places and the families. But she spent her married life at Ashton in Devon, and she is a very, very important early, what you might call, proto-feminist poet. And I actually was asked by Tony Fraser of Shearsman Books, who's now based in Bristol but was before that based in Exeter, he asked me if I would be interested in editing a copy of a paperback edition of Mary Lady Chudley's poetry. So I did that a few years ago, and that is actually out there available if anyone's interested in reading her poems.
Well, here's an idea for the mighty book, isn't it? I think we could have a little look at that, perhaps.
Well, absolutely. There's a lot one can say about Mary Lady Chudley, because, again, although people sort of studying that period of history, and perhaps some sort of writers and women and men even interested in so-called feminist writing would be aware of her, they may not be familiar enough with her to realize that actually her poetry was quite significant for the time. She was a very much a leading poet of her time. She knew Dryden very well. And she knew Dryden. Actually, she was living and related through her family to the Cliffords at Uggbrook. So there's quite a lot there to bring out. And I mean, one could easily write a whole book about her, quite easily.
Yes, we could see a series coming. Now, quite apart from researching and, of course, writing this book, which is very close to being published, of course, another strand to what you do is to write your own poetry.
Oh, yes.
About the, in some cases, actually about the writers of the Southwest.
Yes.
Are you going to give us one of those poems this morning?
Would you like me to?
Yes, well,
I
think
indeed.
We have, we've got nearly 25 minutes left of the programme. I think we could fit in at least two poems. We'll see how we get on.
Okay.
Shall we start with one about a Southwest woman writer?
Well, I think, in that case, I think one of the best ones to start off with, it comes from the long sequence, which is actually in the book Tessitura, but it's actually about Anne Dowridge, so it's a very good one to start with, probably. The poem, I began this poem, the sequence was started because I thought I would have a go at writing a sonnet, a conventional sonnet based on each of these women writers, and because I'm a slightly more, you might call, experimental writer, I found it was too restricting, and so gradually, as the time went by, I found myself sort of being kind of pushed, and I had to sort of broaden out from the sonnet restrictions. So this poem is sort of loosely a sonnet, and it was started from my visit to Mount Edgecombe when I found a portrait on one of the landings, which was actually of a girl or a young woman of that period, 16th century, but her identity was not known. And I just thought to myself, I wonder if this could have been Anne Dowridge. And it started me off on a train of thought, and gradually this poem appeared. Anne Edgecombe Dowridge. I can only find you through your father's husband, nephew, brother, sons. You could seek yourself through only male personae, his prose texts. Your mother won't stop swapping names. Your niece is you. You might be in her grave. There's a portrait on the upper corridor of the house your father built. Girl, unknown, of the family, of the time. I would that she was you. Her kirtle is folded pleat over pleat upon pleat. the overskirts taffeta sheen, a surprise sage green, and that stolid stare from where you follow your future, round and around the upper landing, letting the steps of visitors repeat themselves into emptiness, whilst the inked hollows of your eyes remain black and still. So that's Anne Edgecombe. I have to say that the actual poem is a layered poem, and one of the few problems I had with the editor of Shearsman, Tony Fraser, is how to lay out some of these poems, because in my mind it's actually layered with a prose text underneath the poem. And Tony's been very clever. What he's done is he's put the prose text underneath it. So if anyone does have a look at the book, you'll see my prose text actually written in italics beneath the poem. And I think it works like that. And the prose text arose from a visit to Coteel, which was also one of the Edgecombe homes at that time. And I was sort of inspired to write it by the tapestries which appeared, which are in the house there. Again, thinking that possibly this Anne Dowrich would have known these tapestries and the stories that they could tell. So there was a little bit of a prose, as I said, a little bit of a prose text to the poem, but obviously I can't read it at the same time.
Well, your introduction, of course, takes us there, and I could feel the intrigue of looking at that picture, although I doubt I've ever seen it. I don't think I've been to that place, but I can imagine how one would feel looking at and wondering if it was the person that we were thinking
Absolutely,
of.
Absolutely, yes.
And you mentioned a book, of course, for anyone who's tuned in, we're talking about your new volume of poems called Tessitura.
Yes,
with a beautiful picture of Dartmoor on the front. Tessitura, of course, meaning texture or tapestry. So it's the you're giving us the sense, the feel of life in Devon, and not just in the present day, in the past as well. Now, in a few moments, it would be nice if we had another poem, perhaps one of your, not about a Southwest writer, but about the Southwest itself.
Okay, that's absolutely fine. Yes, I can read you a poem, which is a fairly long poem, but it's actually, you mentioned the cover of Tessitura. This is actually in the book, this poem that I'll read when you're ready. It's a very strange poem, really. Its beginnings were very strange, because I was on visiting Dartmoor that day. I often like visiting Dartmoor, as lots of Devonshire people do, obviously. But when we were at Thornton Tor, which I don't know if you're familiar with Thornton Tor, but it's a very easy tour to find and to go to and everything, and you can park beneath it and everything. We were visiting Thornton Tor, and for some strange reason, I just had this very surreal kind of vision, which it doesn't often happen to me, but it did that day. And it was a very peculiarly surreal vision, because it was of a ballerina dancing in front of the moorland landscape. And I'm not particularly interested in ballet, don't know anything about it, but I think not long before that, I'd watched on the television Darcy Bustle's last professional performance of Macmillan's Song of the Earth. And I think possibly something about her performance, about her dancing of that ballet, must have sort of triggered something. So I had this vision of her in front of the tour, and it sort of haunted me. I just couldn't sort of get it out of my head. And in the end, I ended up writing this poem. It's just called Ballerina's Song of the Earth. Would you like me to read it now?
I think that would be lovely. I'd love to hear that.
Okay. Ballerina's Song of the Earth, for Darcy Bustle. Someone draws a circle, pencil line, ornate in grey, around that empty space, the virtual, veritable land, where no one is except a bird, lost bride, butterfly, free from its cage. Have you ever, just once, considered latent, wasted talent, where words are lost in ether, though they might alight on a limb of branch or perch a sigil on the stalk of a rose? Where does the phrase of incomplete text finish? How long does it exist in air before it dies or drops to earth, dead stone? And no, she couldn't have been there, all a figment in that. You know, don't you, what I mean? Though Bracken was an arena for theatre. The day I saw her on the moor, I'd been considering the self, fulfillment. Those who say they can have and do everything, anything, as and when they like, and thinking how fortunate they must be. Just to the north, high on the crown of Sort and Tor, there's a metamorphosis of rocks. Beneath my feet, this moorscape edge, grass hillocks on green earth salted with dew. She, sashayed down from mid-grey skies, ballerina! You must have seen her dancing on the ground. Demi-plie, pirouettes on point, catch light on her dress as she skims and spirals her dervish of whirling death. It's chiffon and satin, a border of organdi, a net shimmer of lilac cerise, blue, sequins, butterflying everywhere. She's intent on inner voices, singing the song where she went on the night of her final farewell to earth. I caught the last glimpse, her terre-à-terre, before she'd gone, one with the hang glider behind the tor, the stones out of view of sight. And now don't know if she came to be part of a poem, to tell us something, or even flew in just for fun, a trick of light, simplicity itself disguised in a moving text of ballet dress. You do know she won't return.
Extraordinary. Yes, I felt I was right there. That actually is the flavour that we had last Thursday when you were reading in the black box. You'd get fully caught up in what you're saying.
Well, thank you.
And a beautiful, beautiful image of Darcy Bustle dancing around Sort and Tor. And is this a common thing that you things can come to you almost out of nowhere?
Occasionally, but not always. I think poet, the kind of impetus, the inspiration for any poets, and everyone says different things, don't they? And for myself, I just find it's very different. Sometimes I just have a intellectual idea in my head, and I know I want to somehow get it on. This is how it happens with the woman writers. I know I want to write about them, so sometimes it takes a while to find an image or a phrase, or it just happens in different ways. One of the few poems that I did, it did happen very, very quickly, I suppose, was back in 1990 when we had the big storm of the southwest. I think it was 1990. No, I think it was 1990. It was the anniversary, the day of my book launch, which is very strange, the 25th. So it was 1990, I think, the one I'm thinking about. But what happened was I found out, or somebody told us, that all the trees in the garden that we'd been brought up in mid-Devon, had been blown down in the gale. And I was so distressed to hear that news, because I absolutely loved these trees, because they were planted by my grandfather. And I was so distressed, I thought, I'm going to have to write a poem about that. So I tried and I tried, and just nothing worked, absolutely nothing worked. And then a few months later, I don't know, it was like a little voice inside me said, do it again, you can do it. And I wrote this poem in the voice of the child, my child, inner child, and it just came out just like that. And I found I was quite pleased with the poem at the end, but that doesn't happen very often for me. Nor do I often have surreal images in front of Dartmoor.
It's a very, very odd coincidence, because actually on Friday last week we listened to Le Boeuf sur le Toit, The Ox on the Roof, the surreal ballet.
Oh, yes.
By Darius Milhaud down at Totnes. And that was partly in my mind as well. I was almost imagining Charlie Chaplin dancing around the screen. So... very much a Dartmoor flavour. Now, when you're writing these poems, as you say, they don't always come straight away.
No.
Will you try and do more than one at once?
More than one poem?
Yes.
Yes, I have. To be quite honest with you, I have all sorts of things in my mind. Now, another sort of thread of what I'm trying to do, which is also very, very pertinent to Devon, particularly people who do family history, is I'm very, very interested in personal family history. And I find it kind of interweaves with the research on the Devon women writers, because inevitably, if, like in my case, most of the roots of my family do come from Devon, in nearly every thread in some way or another. So inevitably I'll go to a place or find out a place, and then you can sort of connect it with some other thread of the other kind of the research. So I'm also trying to write a few poems based on particular facts and details of different individuals that I found in our personal past, which is quite intriguing. And then I'm trying to use them as a way of weaving in the poem that I'm trying to write at the moment, which is a long sequence titled Cassandra, but not yet published or anything.
Well, we won't go for a pre-published. But we have 10 minutes left. Would you like to squeeze in one more poem, one of the ones you just mentioned?
One of the ones from the family?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Well, they're quite short, actually, Luke. So what I could do is to read you... One or two of them are actually in the collection. So I'll start off with one of them that's in the collection. They're very short. They're fragments, really. They're just little fragments, which I've sort of tried to put together from facts that I've found out about various individuals. Obviously, because they're in the past, they're not necessarily true to these people's lives, but just how one tries to conjure up a past. The first one is called Susanna Gidley Abbott, who came from Dean Prior in the 18th century. She was a family of Woolcombe. She was from a family of Woolcombers, and I kind of got a bit interested in her, and I wrote a tiny little thing, and it's just called 1760, Deancombe. My wheel turns small and vistas up by Hannaford. Behind its frames, fibres twist. Flyer of time rotates. I, spinner, left holding the yarn. Then there's another one, which is one of her ancestors, one of my great-great-great-grandfathers, John Abbott, another Woolcomber, also from Dean Prior, which I'm sure many of your listeners will know is where the 17th century writer Herrick was the vicar for so many years. But this poem is just on John Abbott, the Woolcomber. This poem also appears in my collection. Every evening, sundown, shadowed by wood's dark gorge, he stands at the foot, his vegetable plot. How the ancient abbot's way weaves its path across Lansdowne, out along his own past grandfather's stretch behind him. So that's two of the abbot ones. I could then go back to East Budley in East Devon, where another strand of the family were yeoman farmers for many, many generations. And there's a short poem I wrote about one of my great-grandmothers who was called Lydia Lugg. And she was actually born on Jersey. Her parents went to Jersey from Devon. And then she was sent back to live in East Budley with her aunt and uncle when she was very young, when she was only 9. And then eventually she met my great-grandfather, Richard Harris. And I visited the area last year, actually, and kind of this poem sort of appeared after it. Lydia Lugg at East Budley, 1842. Sundays, after lunch with Richard, she follows snaking sheep tracks up and over outcrops to the common, then up and over bound stones to Bystock, its gorse high, ablaze with flame, fanning out distant to Moreland's grey vista. In the copse, lone pines whine their lament. She sees the split cones, her soul swinging its way back to her mother source. How a few might make their way up over moors, south to the sea, In her mind's eye, they drift in dark, like stars disperse new seeds across the Channel's island. So that's Lydia Lugg. And then I could also read you William Harris, who also came from that area, who was land agent of the Roll Estate. And I got very interested in him because of his connection with the gardens at Bicton. I found that, I'm sure people who know Bicton know much more than me, but that there's quite a well-known monkey puzzle avenue there. And my great-great-grandfather would have been there at the time of the planting of the monkey puzzle avenue. So I thought I would have a go at writing a little bit about him. William Harris, 1812-1895, Bicton. He just hammered that final nail in his master's tomb, turns with pride to survey his work. It's bold against the distant violet backdrop of rippling Devon Hills. Close by, gorse, yellow, gauzes the green history of those patchwork fields. And here, running away beside and from him, far along the estate perimeter, the newly planted Orucaria Avenue, its years yet to come. At the far end, through the aisle of trees, a wraith-like speck, tiny ring-knitted girl, cup in nose in her hand held out towards him. He knows they are keys to her own future, striking as the puzzle's needles will one day be. So that's a few of my family history poems.
Delicious gems from history, and of course very relevant. Everyone's conjuring up pictures of places which I've been to, and in fact, as you spoke, I remembered those Araucaria trees going up from the main gate at Bicton.
Yes, absolutely.
Been past them so many times and not really thought about it, when they would have been planted and who would be involved. It's lovely to hear it, and of course in your beautiful words it brings the whole thing to life.
Well, thank you very much.
It's so kind of you to join us again this morning, Julia.
It's okay, well, I've really enjoyed it. It's really good to have the opportunity to share some of my research with people who are listening, who hopefully listening, and who are from the southwest and obviously from Devon. Because my great passion now, as I grow a little bit older, is to share what I've found, because I feel it's really important to future generations that local people should be aware of what's been missed and what's been kind of eradicated from our literature, really. So this is my passion, I guess, now.
Well, I think that's very, very beautiful. And the pieces, most of the pieces that we heard, although in fact not all, are in your new volume, which is called Tessitura.
Yes, quite a lot of them are in there, but not all the family ones. One or two of the family ones are in there, but I think all the others that I've read this morning are included.
So we've had a very special bonus this morning. And you were selling copies at the Black Box last week. Where can people get a copy of your...
Okay, well, they can get copies from the publisher, Shearsman Books, who I think it's shearsman.com. It's fairly easy to find on the internet if you just type in Shearsman.
Shearsman.com.
Yes. I think so. Shall I have a quick look?
No, I'll put a link on the
Classical
Journey website.
I think it's very, very easy to find him anyway.
Shearsman, that's all that we have to remember.
And then, obviously, the normal sources, Amazon and all the bookshops, will be able to get them on. And some of them have them. I have some copies, but at the moment, what I'm endeavouring to do is to do a proper website for myself as a writer. So, eventually, probably I'll have them available on there, but not quite yet.
Oh, well, thank you very much for joining us, Julie.
It's been a pleasure.
1 minute to 12 now. You've filled the time perfectly. And just to finish the programme, I've got a little bit of music here by two Devon artists. Steve Thorpe, who crushes up rock, local rocks, to make paintings with the pigments, and his friend Paul Ramsey put together an installation called Works of Friction, I think, sorry about that. But Paul Ramsey has now come out with his own LP of music for the piano, and this is, I think, possibly touching on one of the themes that you introduced there, By the Water. So thank you once again, Julie. Lovely
well,
to speak to you.
Thank you very much for letting me come on to the station this morning, Luke. Thank you very much.
Cheerio.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
Welcome, yes.